Hello. Good morning. My name is Alan Halper, and I'm on the Planning Committee. I first met Art McDonald, our theme speaker, during the last millennium when I had hair on the top of my head and the hair on the front of my face was kind of a reddish brown. And I think Art's was a little darker, too. But my first SI, actually, the theme speaker was a woman named Barbara Peskin, who I, as a young father, ended up needing a little bit of male counsel after that. And I looked to a couple older fellas, a wonderfully effervescent fellow, the late Walter Courtley, and he introduced me to Art. And I know there are a number of you in the crowd that have known Art for some time, and you probably met him across the... there was a pulpit between you. I met him. There was a tennis net between us. And I remember there'd be shots that would whistle by outside of my reach or even worse, right at my feet, and there'd be this irrepressible cackle from the other side of the net. And that was Art. And a number of years later, I was a guest at a mosque in the Oakland section of Pittsburgh, and I was trying my best but kind of fumbling an explanation of what my religion or faith was. And I mentioned UU, and the imam said, "Oh, Art McDonald." So he's about as good a representation, I think, as we could get. So, Art?
Morning, folks. The reason I didn't know Al was going to say that about the imam, but the reason I think he remembered my name is he was always kind of evangelizing and hoping that somehow this UU would become a Muslim. You know, so I have my props here, which I hope as the week goes on, I'll explain. Take my hat off. I wear that hat because it's funny Al should mention hair. I wear that hat because I don't want to mess my hair up on the way over, you know. And the other prop is this brush. My partner in connubial bliss, that woman Melanie out there, who I've been married to fortunately and beautifully for 30 years, is always worried about how bad I look. And so I bring this brush. One of the members of Allegheny years ago said to me, she said she always worried about having bad hair days until she met me. And she no longer worries about that. Pat Downey somewhere in the front here, I bet. There she is. Your hair's looking pretty good, Pat. So, folks, thank you, Alan, and Allison, and Amy, and all the others who put this together and have been in touch with us for a long time. Melanie and I were just in Ireland for 4 weeks. I'm always going as often as I can to try to deepen my connection to my own heritage, and this Polish wonderful wife goes along with the gig. And so we went off to a place called Kropatrick. If you're Irish, you might know that. If you're not Irish, you may have heard of it. It's this kind of sacred mountain that supposedly St. Patrick stayed for 40 days on. And people climb it for religious reasons or not, just to climb Kropatrick. It takes a couple hours up and a couple hours back. And so I wasn't that interested in doing this, but once I got there, I got bitten, and I had to do it. So I climbed Kropatrick and got to the top. It was a challenge, but I got there. And on the way down, the last part going up and first part coming down, very steep. So on the way down, about halfway down, there's this group of young folks, 12, 13 years old, with their teacher, I guess. And they're huffing and puffing and grimacing and looking unhappy as all get out. And the teacher, as I'm passing, says, "Excuse me, sir, but would you mind telling me how old you are?" And I said, "Not a bit, I'm 66. He turns around and, as if he had a megaphone, said, "Hey, guys, this guy's 66 years old, and he made it. so you can do it. I was not popular with that crowd of 12-year-olds. So I share that story because I'm a little surprised, to be perfectly honest with you. I was asked to do this. At this age and at this part of my career in ministry, I figured there's someone else much younger, much smarter, much wider in viewpoint that can help us along in this struggle to do justice and learn our spirituality. So I'm kind of, it's a little bit like, you know, Groucho Marx once said, would I want to be a member of a club that would have me as a member? So I thought to myself, would I want to go to Summer Institute that would have me as the theme speaker? And I was unclear about the answer to that. This morning, Kim Brenneman, I remember, but anyway, Kim, you know who you are. Kim said, are you ready? And I said, almost, Kim. This was about 8:30. On the other hand, I said, I've been working on this for 40 years, so I'm almost ready. It's kind of like Woody Allen in Sleeper. Do you remember he woke up after 150 years? I've been in therapy 150 years, and I'm almost cured. So I said, I'm almost ready, Kim. So what I hope to do this week, and I hope it works for you, one is never really sure. That's the risk of being in a position like this. You're never really sure if you've got something that's really helpful to people. But part of what I'm going to do is share a personal journey, particularly this morning, of 40 years in ministry, what I call a theological narrative. I could have called this talk, and by the way, the words on that can are ash can theology. So it could have been ash can theology, which as the week goes on, I hope to explain if we all survive this. But what I want to do this morning is this kind of personal narrative. I hope it's appropriate. I hope it helps you. And what I want you to do is think about your own personal narrative. Maybe if that sort of is useful to you, you can think about your own spiritual journey, what you think about people of faith, people, religious people being involved in social struggle, in social justice. Think about how you personally approach that and what you think of as spirituality. And I hope it's going to be a conversation. I know this part isn't a conversation, this morning part, but this afternoon hopefully will be. But one of the members of Allegheny said a very nice thing to me toward the end of my time there. He said, Art, you know, Sunday morning, I know you're preaching and it's a bully pulpit and all that. He said, but I always had a feeling that when you were preaching that we were having a conversation. And I thought, what a wonderful thing to say. And so I hope that even though I'm talking and you're listening, hopefully, that it feels like a conversation that we're having. So I'll do this personal journey this morning. Tomorrow we'll talk about congregations and social justice. Wednesday, religion, politics, and democracy. Volatile topic. Thursday, the importance of social analysis. How do we do social analysis? Critical thinking and the relation between faith and politics. And lastly, we'll talk about, do we have any role as people of faith, as religious people in U.S. foreign policy and things beyond our world? So this journey, this particular journey in time is always a good challenge. So I've got a clock right here that's ready to bite me at 9:15 or 9:20, so I'll try to keep to it. So the question this morning, sharing this personal journey, is how did I come to this insight that social justice is a spiritual path, not something that I was born into? So my early story is in Roman Catholicism. I was born in 1947, grew up in this very pious Irish ghetto in Boston. I was an altar boy. My brother and I, I'm the youngest of five, but the next to me, who passed on some years ago, we used to celebrate Mass in the attic with Coca-Cola and little Wonder Breads, you know, into circles. And we prayed the rosary every night. 6:45, Cardinal Cushing from Boston was on the radio, and we sat around the radio doing that. It was a very conservative politically and religiously experience. I didn't have that tag then, but I do now, of course. And for those who had this experience, Catholics, the analogy isn't perfect, so don't hold me to this. But Catholics were much like Jews as outsiders in the culture in those years, 40s, 50s, and into the 60s. And, of course, John F. Kennedy was elected president in 1963. That was a major moment, but it easily might not have happened, this Roman Catholic being elected president. So the spirituality I grew up with was a kind of, I would want to say now, you might say disembodied. That is, it was about withdrawal. Spirituality, you were the most holy people went to church all the time. Maybe Mass every day, praying all the time. That was where spirituality was centered in my early growing up. We did have a sense of charity, of doing good works, and people did many good works, but it always seemed pretty secondary to this notion of get to church. And once you're in that sacred building, your spiritual life is growing. So that was the early experience. Holiness was being in church as often as possible. So the 60s come along. I'm in high school in the early 60s, college the late 60s. This time of turmoil, social turmoil, the Vietnam War, which tore this country apart. You know, Judy Collins, any Judy Collins fans here, but Judy Collins always said, you know, 60s was Woodstock and anti-Vietnam. Judy always said, if someone tells you they remember Woodstock, they weren't there. Or she'll say that about the 60s. If they say they remember the 60s, no, they didn't experience them. So this time of incredible turmoil, and I was very much on the sidelines. Vietnam, 1965, it's flaring up. I'm in college. There were protests, but I wasn't part of them. I was watching, but I wasn't part of them. Many in my family thought Martin Luther King was a communist, and in those days that was bad. Maybe it's not so bad now, but in those days being a communist wasn't great, and many thought that King was a communist. Catholics were still trying to be good Americans. We're trying to assimilate and not be suspect, especially Irish Catholics. Who, a colleague, Paul Sawyer, some the ministers might be here, remember Paul, who died not long ago, grew up in the Boston area as a great universalist, but Paul always said, Art, when I was growing up, the worst thing you could be was an Irish Catholic. You know, they drank and they fought, but that's about all they were good for. So I'm watching this whole Vietnam protest and not really part of it, just kind of absorbing. So in 1969, I graduate from college and there's a crisis. What do I do? I tried the Peace Corps for a short period. It wasn't a fit for me. And now I'm back home and the draft is on. This was before the lottery, and I have to make a decision. So I joined the Army, a reserve unit in the Army, 6-year commitment. And I go off to basic training, 6 months of basic training, Fort Jackson, South Carolina. I don't know why I'm there, but what are the alternatives? Seemed like the best of a bunch of bad alternatives. I wouldn't go to Canada, I didn't want to be drafted, and so forth. So I'm in this exercise in basic training, and there's a platoon of 400 or so of us, and we all have our M16s, and on the end of the M16 is a bayonet. And the drill sergeant is instructing this 400 out there, he's on the staging area, he's instructing us to imagine we're in Vietnam, and we're doing hand-to-hand combat with a gook, a Viet Cong. And we hit that gook in the chin with the butt of our rifle. And we knock him over, and he's on the ground, and we thrust our bayonet into his chest. And at the top of our lungs, which I won't do, we yell, kill. K-I-L-L. So that was the indoctrination. And when we came to that point, and I'm going through all the exercises, when it was time to yell kill, the words didn't come out. I didn't plan this. It was not premeditated. They did not come out. And I'm standing there with everyone yelling kill, and I'm not yelling, but I'm simulating that I'm doing this. And I start wondering, holy crap, what am I doing here? How did this happen? I'm learning to do this. What is this all about? So it was an incredible crisis. Now, I vaguely had in mind that in my Catholic tradition at that time, there was an anti-war movement. And it was led mostly, not entirely, in my tradition, by nuns and priests. And a lot of them went to jail. And I couldn't figure that out. What's a nun doing in jail? What's a priest doing in jail? So I vaguely was aware of this. And I knew that there were these brothers, the Berrigans, Phil and Dan. Oh, okay, but that's all I knew. And I also knew that their mentor was a woman, an older woman named Dorothy Day, who they learned everything from. So in this crisis of what am I doing here, learning I'm ready to go kill someone, I go to the library in the, on the base, and I look for a book, anything that would be related to this. And there's Dorothy Day's autobiography in Fort Jackson, South Carolina. What is that doing there? Who got it there? I don't know. And I read this book about Dorothy Day, a woman, if you don't know, started a thing called The Catholic Worker with Peter Morin, 1930, down in the Bowery of New York City. She was a communist, Dorothy, and had this conversion to Catholicism and opened up a flop house for homeless people and spent the rest of her life living with homeless people and protesting war and being the best Catholic she could be. And I said, why didn't anyone tell me about Dorothy Day when I was growing up? What is wrong with this amazing woman? You know, the Catholic Church is now sainting a couple of popes, and I'm still waiting for Dorothy. I mean, these two guys couldn't hold a candle to Dorothy Day. What is going on? What is wrong with the picture? So I read this book about Dorothy, and I said, this whole new idea about religion, about, if you will, Catholicism, about what it is to be a spiritual person, Dorothy Day on the street with homeless people protesting war and doing it nonviolently. So I get home from the army, and I pick up everything I can by Dan Berrigan, this Jesuit priest. I read every one of his books and eventually say, I've got to do what he's doing. This is the model. So I entered seminary in 1972, and Dan Berrigan is the model of what a minister is supposed to be in my head. So based on this different vision of what it is to be a spiritual person, to be a person of faith, to be religious, and so forth, you might say a conversion, a word that maybe doesn't chime with a lot of people. Maybe we think of Paul being knocked off his horse. Not that kind of a conversion, but this sudden insight. Wow, this wow moment, just different thinking about what this all means. So I'm in the seminary, and phase two of this changeover in spirituality. I read a book from Latin America by a Peruvian fellow, little fellow, much shorter than I am, with much messier hair than I am. Gustavo Gutierrez, 5 foot tall, had polio as a kid, has a huge limp, and wrote this incredible book in the early 1970s called Liberation Theology. And I read this book, and I say, wow. Salvation, you know, the universalists are great on salvation, right? Universal salvation, everyone gets in somehow, all right? And so he's talking about salvation. Salvation, he says, is not so much about up there, afterlife in heaven, but it's building this reign of justice and peace of God in this life. And the religious community has a key role in making that happen. And so I said, I have to go to Latin America. I have to feel this firsthand and meet this fellow Gutierrez. So I was in not the Jesuits, but the Dominicans, which is dicey if you know that history, because Dominicans and Jesuits always fought about stupid theological issues, you know, nothing really life important, but always had this competition going. So I'm off to Latin America in 1976 for 6 months, learning a little Spanish, and mostly with children. Children are great Spanish teachers when you're starting out. They have lots of patience, and they're fascinated by the idea that an adult would want to hang around with them. So you can really learn some Spanish from children. So I go to Latin America, and of course, like most people that go to that part of the world for the first time, you're in shock for a while at what you see. And so I lived in a couple different locations in Peru. One location in particular alongside this mountain where people had no electricity, no water. Infant mortality rate was 30 to 40% because of dirty water and so forth. I watched a water, I can't say that word now because from Boston and Pittsburgh, W-A-T-E-R, water. In Boston, it's water. You know, if you do the water, it's water. So W-A-T-E-R. I watched this truck go up the side of the mountain, and people come out with their cans about the size of my ash can to get some water for the day, and pay money for it. Water was not free. So, and I learned from liberation theologians at this time that injustice, what you just saw up that mountain, that's injustice. You got it? That shouldn't be happening in the world we live in. That's human-made, that situation. That's injustice. So I learned from them that injustice is not this personal thing. You do something bad to another person, which is certainly could be unjust. But it's mostly, or the major kind of injustice, is structural. It's structural. What the liberation theologians called institutional violence. Injustice is institutional violence, they called it. And it's sinful in theological terms. And so our job as people of faith is to accompany people who are victims of injustice. And maybe in some ways most of us are, but certainly there are levels of people being oppressed by injustice. And our job is to be in accompany folks in that struggle to overcome this human-made situation of structural violence. And so I reread the Bible, and the Jewish prophets said that really clearly. And the Jewish Jesus said it really clearly, and they're all speaking in the name of this God, this one God. Then a shocking thing happened. I heard about priests and nuns being killed in Latin America, and I thought, wow. But then a bishop was killed in 1980. His name is Oscar Romero, another fellow who should be way up the ladder in sainthood, so I don't know what we're waiting for. He was killed saying Mass, 1980, shot with an M16 from the back of the church. And then a little while after that, four churchwomen were raped and murdered and left on the side of the road. Four churchwomen from the United States. Saints, Jean, Ida, Dorothy, and Maura. And I said, what is going on here? And I watched congressional hearings about these murders of the four churchwomen, and I listened to Alexander Haig, one of our government representatives, Secretary of State, and Jean Kirkpatrick, Ambassador to the United Nations, suggest that these women were political, that they were running away, that they shouldn't have been doing what they were doing. And I was outraged, as was so many people. These women were holy. They were spiritual. They weren't political. They were simply living out what they believed to be their faith in solidarity with victims of structural violence. And they were slaughtered by a system that didn't want to be changed. So the journey deepens. What is spiritual? What it is to be a spiritual person? I'm thinking this is all evolving for me. And in this liberation theology camp, I read an African theologian, female, who said this about spirituality, a very simple explanation of spirituality. Spirituality is the energy by which one lives and which links one's worldview to one's style of life. That's pretty direct. The energy by which one lives and which links one's worldview to one's style of life. I suppose you could just say we take our values and put them into practice. And we reflect upon that. That's spirituality. So I brought that perspective into Unitarian Universalism. After, by the way, ordination in the Catholic tradition, I worked in the South Bronx for 4 years till 1982. Melanie and I met, we left, we married in 1983, came to Pittsburgh. People always blamed Melanie for taking me out of the priesthood. Now, 30 years later, I can say it. I took her out of the nunhood. I was doing the chasing, not Melanie, so let's get that straight. Went to Pittsburgh, worked for the Thomas Merton Center, a wonderful center for peace and justice, still going strong. Went back to Latin America many times, wrote a dissertation, and then stumbled into this church on the north side of Pittsburgh called Allegheny in 1991. That happened because we were at a rally downtown in Pittsburgh, and two of these great Unitarian Universalist warriors, who are no longer with us but are saints in our tradition for me, Ty Luwakala and Shirley Nusser. And they were there at this meeting, and they said, "Art, why don't you come to our church and give a talk?" And I said, "Really? You want me to give a talk?" And they said, "Yeah, anyone can give a talk in our church." So, so I was both inflated and deflated in the same moment, you know. And Leo Nagorski would know that well. Anyone, right, Leo, can give a talk in our church. Fortunately for us, Melanie and myself, Allegheny, and our movement, I might say, Allegheny had a long history of living out its spirituality and religious vision as a beacon of social justice. You know, in the 1950s at Allegheny, the congregation kind of almost disbanded because it was the McCarthy time. And everyone thought there was a communist cell in the Allegheny Church on the north side in 1950. And so a lot of people left because they were afraid. And I thought, what a proud moment to even be thought that we might have had a communist cell there. So once immersed in this world of Unitarian Universalism, which was foreign to me, as I said, Paul Sawyer said to me, the worst thing growing up, Art, as a UU or a Universalist, but Unitarian too, was Irish Catholic, you know. So the reverse was also true. I think, Unitarian Universalism? What the heck? So where do I fit in here? Well, I fit in because this church wanted me to be in the neighborhood and to do social organizing and social action. And I understood that because my theological base was exactly that. Evolving as spirituality is doing social justice. Dorothy Day out in the street, I got that. And this church allowed me to bring that with me without a lot of questions. They kind of set me loose. The truth is they were desperate. They were totally desperate. And actually, if there's anything that I've done in UUism that I would say borders on being a genius is that I've served two churches in UU, and both of them were dying. And so to take ministry job in two churches that are dying, you can't fail. You know? I mean, if the church closes, it's not your fault. It's already on a downward slide. And if the church prospers, they actually think you know what you're doing. Which wasn't true. But nevertheless, we prospered enough to still be alive today. But the bridge for me to make this transition into Unitarian Universalism smoothly enough was a giant figure in our movement that I hope some of you know something about, died in 1994, named James Luther Adams. He's one of our theological lights. Maybe the bookstore has a few of his books. I hope so, because he's a giant, James Luther Adams. And Adams, so I came to UU through Catholicism, as more and more actually have in these recent years. And James Luther Adams came to UU through, he was a Baptist, a serious, actually grew up fundamentalist kind of Baptist. So, and James Luther Adams and I, we intersect. And his theology is a kind of early seeds of a liberation theology in UU, I would say. And so Adams helped ground me then. I said, I can do this UU thing because there's someone like James Luther Adams. And James Luther Adams, well, he had lots of insights, but one key one that he actually borrowed from William Ellery Channing, this giant Unitarian, right, from the early part of the 19th century, who actually gave this wonderful speech that was responsible in some ways for Unitarianism being defined, William Ellery Channing, who Emerson said was our bishop. Emerson said, Channing's our bishop. William Ellery Channing, who there was a book written about him, The Reluctant Radical. He was a radical, but a reluctant one. It's a wonderful book by Jack Mendelsohn, who recently died. Wonderful book. Anyway, Channing had the insight that religion is a social principle, a social principle. And Adams picked up on that. And Adams actually wrote some wonderful stuff about what he called, Adams was a gentle, loving fellow, but he could be sharp and critical of sham religion. And sham religion to Adams was this religion which was all about withdrawal from the social maelstrom. About withdrawal. That was sham religion to him. Religion is fundamentally a social principle. It had social implications. It was about making the world a better place. Adams had a funny quip once, and again, he was a very gentle guy, but every once in a while, he said, the problem, and he was a Unitarian, of course, he said, but the problem I see with Unitarianism, particularly this brand that says, well, you know, you can believe what you want, and, you know, we're really inclusive and so forth. Adams said, the problem with Unitarianism is you can't flunk. Anyway, Adams wrote lots of great things. He's got one of the books of his articles is called The Prophethood of All Believers, and it's a series of articles that are powerful about authentic religion. And I've read him over and over again, and much of his focus is to try to reclaim, because we know that particularly the Unitarians, not so much the Universalists, but the Unitarians tried to kind of wash their hands of the whole biblical tradition. But Adams tried to reclaim it as part of our roots, which they clearly are, in the best sense. And so Adams kind of raised up the Jewish prophets and the Jewish Jesus and how they spoke truth to power. Spoke truth to power, which for Adams, and later in the week I'll talk about his insights about power and why we should seek power and an appropriate way to seek power. So Adams helped me get settled theologically and spiritually in UU. Now, one of my high points in UU is being asked by Scott Alexander, who was a speaker here some years back, Reverend Scott Alexander, who put together a book called Everyday Spiritual Practice. And Scott asked myself and two colleagues, Steve Fur and Deb Holder, two great colleagues, asked the three of us to write an article entitled Social Justice as a Spiritual Practice. So we had to figure out what that meant. So there was one anecdote that I used in that article, in that book, maybe in the bookstore, I don't know, Everyday Spiritual Practice. There was one anecdote I used to try to explain what I meant by social justice as a spiritual practice. I knew an activist in Pittsburgh named Gail Austin, an African-American woman who in Pittsburgh was major in the anti-apartheid movement. Anyway, Gail used to go around to black churches and talk about neighborhood organizing and activism and try to get people stirred up and try to get people involved and so forth. And one day, one of the elderly black women in one of the churches came up to Gail afterwards and said, "Oh, Gail, you are so spiritual. You are so spiritual, Gail. It's so great you're here." So some days after that experience, Gail, a very close friend, said to me, "Art, you're a minister. You have to help me with this." A woman came up to me after a speech and said I was spiritual. "Art, I'm an atheist. How can I be spiritual?" I was supposed to explain that to her. So I went through the litany of African-American spiritual saints. Howard Thurman, Dr. King, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Katie Cannon, blah, 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 blah. This wonderful history of black spiritual tradition, embodied spirituality, where prayer and meditation and celebrating and hooting and shouting and reflection and community activism and justice were all one. It was a seamless garment. There was no division here. So I said to Gail to be spiritual. That woman was saying, "Gail, only a holy person, a spiritual person, would be such a great social activist. Because in that woman's mind, they are one. You can't separate these realities." A wonderful spiritual writer, contemporary, named Janet Ruffing says this: "We live in a time of privatization of religion, which separates the mystical, the inner, and the contemplative life from the worldly life of politics, business, and public life. What is needed is rather a balance and a deep relationship between reflection, contemplation, and action, theory and practice, mysticism and ethical behavior, embodied spirituality. The prophets, the Jewish prophets in the Older Testament, were political mystics, she says. They experienced God or the divine and applied that experience to criticism of political leaders and kings and so forth. So in the few minutes I have left, I know we're supposed to end at 10:15. Allison gave me permission to go to 10:20. So unless there's this, well, obviously anyone can leave whenever they want. Because as we know, you can't flunk Unitarianism, right? Anyway, 10:20, we've got 7 minutes, Allison and Alan. So finally, I want to just leave you with these thoughts for today around this question of fleshing out my journey, spiritual journey, and maybe hoping it will stir something in you about your own journey and how you understand spirituality, if you have an understanding of it, and where social justice fits in. I want to talk right now, and maybe I'll finish tomorrow morning, I don't know, but there's a 20th century spiritual writer who I think knows more than almost anyone about this relationship that Janet Ruffing spoke to, of the relationship between action and contemplation and the essential nature of that relationship. If they are not together, if they're pulled apart in some way, we've gone haywire. Our justice activity is just furious activity going nowhere and probably violent. So the importance of action and contemplation, or as the Marxists say, and Merton spent a lot of time dialoguing with Marxists, believe it or not, this Catholic monk, theory and practice. Theory and practice. You know, the back and forth, theory and practice. Activity and stepping back and thinking about it and going back into it. Theory and practice, action, reflection. So I was asked, again, it was very surprising to me. I'm always willing to be surprised. A couple of years ago, the Merton Center in Pittsburgh, this great center of peace and justice, was celebrating its 40th anniversary. And they asked me to come and give a talk about Thomas Merton. And basically, the question was, why does it make sense 40 years later, even longer since his death, does it make sense to call a center for peace and justice after a dead white monk? Monk. Why does that make sense? That was sort of the assignment. And so Merton died in 68. And the last 10 years of his life, and he stayed in the monastery at Gethsemane in Kentucky. The last 10 years of his life, after writing much on prayer and meditation and blah, 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 he wrote all about social issues, about racism, about anti-nuclear activities, about war and peace, about struggle in Latin America and so forth and so on. This guy in the monastery spent 10 years writing this. Furthermore, and this is more important than all the things he wrote, and he wrote a lot, that all these activists, not only Catholic but others, like A.J. Mustey, for example, who I think was a Quaker maybe, but great anti-war activist, every year they would go down to Gethsemane in Kentucky, meet with Merton, have a retreat, and talk about their social action. And at that time they were breaking into draft files and pouring blood on, trying to, that was their way of protesting the war. So they would meet with Merton, who was their spiritual chaplain, and say, this is what we're going to do, this is what we're thinking, what do you, let's pray about it, let's think about it. And Merton would give them feedback and not always agree with their actions. They had a lot of fights. Because Merton was an advocate of nonviolence, and he thought some of their civil disobedience bordered on violence, and so he would challenge them with that all the time. So he didn't always agree. And at one point actually withdrew and said, don't come anymore because I don't really like what you're doing. But he got over it pretty quickly. I think Dorothy Day intervened and said, Thomas, you meet with these people. Dorothy was always kind of in charge, and everyone deferred to Dorothy Day. So he was kind of a chaplain. So there's a paradox here. And Merton loved paradox. And the paradox is, how could a monk living away from the world be so sharp on social criticism and help activists discern what would be appropriate activity given their values and so forth? That's the paradox of Thomas Merton. But it's also the paradox of the Dalai Lama, and Thich Nhat Hanh, and a group of Buddhist monks who walk to our church every year on this many hundred miles walk for peace through Essex, Massachusetts, and who we host every year and so forth. And so that's the paradox. These people who have this monastic view see things so clearly. So if you read Thomas Merton now, he died in 68. If you read him now, you think, my God, he wrote this last week. Because he talks about white-collar violence, institutional violence, the crash that we went through 5 years ago. He would call that institutional white-collar violence on all the rest of us. He talks about war and technology and this terrible relationship between war and technology. How about drones? How about war and technology and drones? He talks about torture, Abu Ghraib, torture. And he has amazing things to say about nonviolence. And the biggest challenge he offers is the adversary is someone you have to listen to, because the adversary, no matter how much you hate what they stand for, you can learn something from them. And the minute you shut them off, is that a buzzer for me? No. The minute you shut off, instead of a hook, a buzzer, no. Uh-oh. Maybe it's in here. So Merton would say, the minute you shut off the adversary and you dismiss them, you've done something violent. Now, test that on the person whose message you dislike the most and see if you can do it. And listen to them and see if you can learn. And the last thing he said about nonviolence is, the problem with activists is that excessive activity is violent. It becomes violent. So it's a message to all of us that are wedded to social justice and social activity to make sure that we don't become excessive about it and don't reflect and don't pray and don't meditate and so forth, because ultimately it turns violent when that happens. I'll start tomorrow with this, but I'll just leave you with this thought. That in the last speech Merton gave was about Marxism. Okay, so here he is, this monk, contemplative monk, talking about Marxism. He did this because in the mid-1960s, he was in California giving a speech, and there were a bunch of young Marxists there. And they challenged him and said, you know, Mr. Merton, we're the real monks. These young radical Marxist students said, we are the real monks, not you. Meaning that, you know, you've sort of withdrawn from the world, but we're in the social struggle doing our theory and practice. We're the real monks. And so Merton took that to heart. And then the last speech he gave before he died by an accident, he was electrocuted, was on monasticism and Marxism, the relationship, and the importance of, even most of us aren't going to be monks, but the importance of the monastic perspective to step back and be able to look critically at what's going on in society. Think about it, pray about it, and then act. And we'll pick up there tomorrow. Thanks for your patience.